The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There is a growing awareness that something's not quite right. Investors are figuring it out. Analysts on Wall Street are figuring it out. They're not quite sure what behavior modifications they should adopt, but it's not lost on them anymore. And I think this is, again, the point where an investor says, I have just enough fuel to land it. I need to disengage now and get home, put this thing on the ground.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Boy, Dave, it seems like forever since we've actually sat in the studio together. You're just finishing up the Naples conference. In fact, you're going into consultations right now. I thought you might want to mention that you're still coming into Orlando, and there's still a chance for people who are in the area to come and meet you and maybe sit down with you in the Florida area, or it's even worth the drive if you're in the surrounding states.
You know, just a great reminder of what it takes to run an effective company, and it's having really remarkable people around you. I've been on the road for the better part of a month. We're coming into the final stretch of client conferences. Orlando is the last one. And to be out of the office for that amount of time and know that our management teams are operating smoothly, I'm remarkably blessed by amazing people around me, both our wealth management company and our precious metals brokerage company. So, you know, heading back home as we get back in December will be great to reengage the day-to-day there in the office. But again, grateful that we've got such great people keeping track of things in between.
Well, one of the things that's so humbling, Dave, is meeting also the people who do business with us, because I agree, you've got great staff and great people who work with you here in the business. But in a way, our clients are almost like family, and they're almost like part of the staff as well. It's humbling to hear. I was just talking to our editor before you got on the line, Ed, just how humbling it is when people come up at these conferences and they say, thank you so much for the commentary. I listen every week. Well, you know, when you're sitting here and it's just, you know, 3, 4, 5 people putting something together, you don't really realize that it can really impact thousands of lives. And so I think these conferences, meeting people face to face, is a good reminder that there are real people on the other end of that speaker giving up real time in their lives to listen to some of the things that you have to say.
Well, we certainly plan on being out and about in 2018 and look forward to being in different cities next year and meeting with our clients as they are scattered sort of hither and yon in the tens of thousands. So look forward to that.
Well, you know, in 6 of the 7 conferences, Dave, I can't speak for Orlando, but in 6 of the 7 conferences, Bitcoin is one of the first questions that comes up. And I can't help but think over the last 5 or 6 weeks, while these conferences have been going on, we've seen the capitalization of Bitcoin go from less than 100 billion to over 162 billion at this point. Bitcoin is nearing 10,000 as far as the price level. And I was just reading an article that you had brought up to me that says the capitalization right now of Bitcoin is larger than Disney, larger than IBM. I mean, this reminds me.
To infinity and beyond, says the right here.
It reminds me of the tech stock bubble when Pets.com, the little sock puppet, that company got to be larger than all of the airlines combined in America before it popped. And when it popped, it just disappeared.
Well, I think we will continue to see Bitcoin go higher. And that's just a reality. Bull markets, or if you want to call them manias, go until they can't go anymore. And that is when you run out of buyers, then all of your buyers turn to net selling and you begin to see price dynamics on the downside. Bitcoin has proven itself to be very volatile, which is helpful on the upside, but can lose 60 to 80% in a short period of time. We're still very fascinated by blockchain technology and its iterations, perhaps even the cannibalization that we see from that technology in various places, whether you're talking about escrow companies, title companies, which have played a significant role in land and property industries and may play no role in the future, given what can be embedded in blockchain.
Well, you know, Dave, you talk about when you run out of buyers, that can happen in any market. But there's one market in particular that does not seem to be happening since the financial crisis, and that is the debt markets. You know, if you've got an automatic buyer, someone who's coming in from the central banking community and buying up all of the debt assets, interest rates they go to zero and they don't seem to rise. You know, we can talk about Bitcoin being larger than Disney, but that's still only $162 billion. We've got trillions and trillions in the debt markets that people in the past have been dependent on the interest rates, you know, 3-4, the magic 5% to be able to retire. That's gone away. We haven't seen anything like that for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, Bloomberg wrote this last week, I'm melting, and the dying lament of a wicked witch is what they were referring to. An apt description, as they write, of what's happening to bond yields since the financial crisis, according to Bank of America Merrill Lynch. In 2008, there was $28 trillion of debt yielding 4% or more. And in that Bloomberg article, they go on to say now it's down to $3 trillion. An era of unprecedented monetary accommodation and structurally lower growth has been accompanied by a seemingly insatiable search for yield. Investors will now accept lower relative returns on risky debt or extend duration to clip coupons on sovereign bonds that still aren't anywhere close to pre-crisis levels.
Okay, so just to repeat, $28 trillion were yielding better than 4% back in 2008. Now, that's our memory. I mean, you talk to someone who retired back in the early 2000s, and they'd say, yeah, I retired because I knew I could get 4% on my money. You know, you have $1 million, that's $40,000 a year that you're bringing in. But at this point, if you have $1 million, you can't even bring in $10,000 or $12,000 in the same kind of instrument. And what you're saying is $28 trillion was yielding 4% or more about 10 years ago. Now it's 1/10 of that that you get the 4% or better. But the instrument that you would get your 4% in would be much more dangerous at this point, would it not? Higher risk?
That's right. So I quote the article as a reminder that people can be aware of problems without changing their behavior. And there's an awareness of greater risk for less reward, but without a change in behavior at all. So as long as it works, you might as well go with it. And that's kind of been the trend. $25 trillion in debt has been priced for perfection. You've got a world of low inflation. You've got virtually no volatility in interest rates. Risk is viewed as a thing of the past. There's virtually no consideration for what used to be at the top of mind for people investing in overseas or foreign sovereign bonds. You know, political volatility, but risk is a thing of the past, right? So we have bonds almost universally priced at levels recorded only one at a time in 5,000 years at these kinds of levels.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of people who do things to their body that they know is ultimately going to kill them. Okay, you know, you look at smokers or what have you, and there's an awareness of risk. You can talk to most smokers and they'll say, yeah, I understand that this is probably going to give me cancer or what have you. Yet with many of them, there's not a change of behavior. And do you think, you know, in a way, is it a little bit like a codependent relationship? In other words, there's a lot of intolerable conditions that they can put up with as long as their current certain needs are met, you know, the immediate need. In this case, it would be income.
That's right. As long as you provide income, you've got those intolerable conditions that can be put up with. I like that. It is a lot like a codependent relationship. It's not healthy, but why change behaviors when the punishment is infrequent and not really present tense, not right in the present moment? So as long as we have free markets, and of course, this is where the problem comes in, because as long as we have free markets, you're assured that punishment will come. The shift towards more normal interest rates, whenever that occurs, I think that's going to leave scars on a generation of investors who accepted a new normal as normal and don't realize that it's actually quite abnormal. The assumption gradually entering into the mental framework of most investors all over the globe seems to be that central banks are in control of prices. And on that basis, it would follow that they're will be no market-driven price volatility, no punishment. So back to that idea of codependence, nothing to worry about. You're getting your needs met. $25 trillion in debt that has been shifted into lower rates. Mind you, $12 trillion of that as of October last year, so roll the clock back 12 months, at negative yields, $2 trillion corporate paper, $10 trillion sovereign debt. This is negative yields, negative. You're not getting anything for it.
You're getting less than what you put in. That's the thing that's amazing. You put $100,000 in and you get $99,000 back and you say thank you to the banker. Excuse me.
Well, I'd say, you know, when I describe pain or punishment in the bond market, it's with a historical focus on the swings of rates from low levels to high levels and back again. And, you know, a world of no volatility, which is more of what we have today, is a world of grave presumptions, control being one of those presumptions.
You know, Dave, you've talked about this, especially after we talked to Russell Napier a couple of years ago, and you asked him, well, how do we move forward? And he said, well, you're going to have to learn how to survive in a command and control environment. Now, one of the things that he's basically saying is that your freedom is lost. There's many freedoms that are sort of hidden in even the prices of items. When you have an unlimited buyer of debt, which is what we've had with the central banks, you can't get real rates of return. And in a way, you're in a form of slavery because, Dave, at this point, you and I both know that for the person who can no longer get that 4% safely because the central bank is their competitive buyer of that same debt, they're having to go out and speculate. A lot of these people are looking at Bitcoin and saying, well, gosh, you know, if this is easy money, then I'm going to go ahead and go into Bitcoin or a stock market that's priced to earnings, you know, 31 years of earnings to break even on the price of the stock market. People are having to speculate, like you said, they're not changing their behavior, but they're chasing whatever they can get to get what they need, which is the income.
And those are cyclically adjusted earnings. But, you know, what you see is people who, in a world of no volatility, assume that there is safety. And again, it presumes a certain control in terms of the outcomes that just doesn't exist. You see that kind of control in people's lives all the time. So it's not just in the markets. You probably know it to be true of yourself as well. You know, you live with this sense of normalcy until disturbance of one sort or another turns peace and calm into temporary chaos or uncertainty. If you've ever lost a job or if you've got dumped by a boyfriend or girlfriend, or if you've experienced a health scare. I don't know if you've ever, you know, I'm cruising along at 30 to 50 miles an hour, and you catch an edge while you're skiing at high speed, and you go from having that sense of control to wondering, how is it that you're in this vortex of snow and ice?
You can call that disturbance.
Yeah, I
mean, yeah, that's definitely disturbance.
Well, when someone presumes control, there's a belief in outcomes which are more or less guaranteed. And, you know, we talked about global debt or U.S. debt. On the Chinese debt markets, a few weeks ago we mentioned this. Not only is the yield curve inversion uncommon in China, first time I recall was 2013 when that happened, and then it started again in June of this year. But it often signals a recession.
Right. And just to remind the listener, the inverted yield curve is when short-term rates actually surpass long-term rates.
That's right. And we know that pattern in the developed world markets, particularly. Perhaps it's different elsewhere, but China has emerged as an economic giant. I could hardly think of it as an emerging market anymore. So I include them in that sort of yield curve pattern where it may be a portent of recession on the horizon. Tightening in the credit markets via the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, has been in place since late last year, kind of an on-again, off-again effort as the PBOC has tried to discourage speculation in a variety of markets, whether it's the real estate market or growth of credit in the shadows or shadow banking. But monetary policy tightening has come in a variety of forms. It's come in the form of higher rates, if you're just looking at Chinese government bonds, and again, back to the yield curve inversion. But we've also seen it with higher rates in the reverse repo market and in other interbank lending rates as well. What are they doing? They're addressing bubble excesses, which have been in play for some time. For more than 12 months, you've seen an active role in terms of regulatory reforms in complement to those monetary policy initiatives.
Well, and wouldn't that be called removing the punch bowl, Dave? I mean, isn't that what a central bank is supposed to do if they're going to go ahead and provide loose monetary policy, tightening before things actually turn to collapse? Isn't that what you would want to see?
Yeah, that's right. So the temperature's right from your regulators and your central bankers, along with yields again, of course, as a part of that. And the intensity increases within the financial system in China to discourage credit growth. This is in contradiction to what we've mentioned on the IMF, assuming that credit growth in China is going to be $27 trillion over the next five-year period. I mean, that's a doubling from the current 27 to $54 trillion total. The IMF says credit is going to double in that five-year period. But frankly, the PBOC's actions are moving against credit expansion and towards bringing expectations back to planet Earth amongst your Chinese investors, where their expectations have been really unrealistic.
Well, and speaking of unrealistic, haven't we seen the Chinese become sort of lax in their worry about volatility, just like we've seen here, like with the Fidelity and the Vanguards, these large, passively managed types of funds? China has smoothed out the volatility in their own asset management products. And so coming from a communist country to a sort of half-communist, half-capitalist country, you've got an entire generation that doesn't really understand crashes or volatility that come with the free market. And China has smoothed that out. What do you think the emotional reaction will be with the Chinese if market forces actually return?
Well, it's an interesting idea that, you know, thus far they've seen the bright side of capitalism, not necessarily the dark side of capitalism. And this is where Schumpeter is not the most popular economist, because in the Schumpeterian world where you have free destruction, somebody does get hurt. And that's the nature of the free markets. That is the nature of capitalism, is that bad ideas ultimately go away. And it's not just about free money and a free lunch, which is kind of on the front end what the Chinese have experienced to this point. So, I mean, you know, last week you had the PBOC, which began to take aim at asset management products. A friend and tactical short manager in-house, Doug Noland, highlighted a Bloomberg article describing how asset growth over the last 13 years in this asset management product space, it's gone from zero to $15 trillion.
Wow, with a T.
That's right, trillion with a T in dollars, not RMB. This is, you know, don't multiply times six or whatever the current exchange rate is. So, yeah, trillion with a T, dollars, not RMB. And the attraction for the Chinese really has been like our mortgage-backed securities market. If you go back, roll the clock back to our market prior to 2008, 2009, everyone assumed that when you bought Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac paper, you were buying mortgage-backed securities paper, that there was an implicit guarantee. You got a little bit more return than treasuries, but the implicit guarantee of the government was there. And, you know, that has been the guaranteed government protection of invested capital. That's been the assumption of Chinese investors with these asset management products now for some time.
And that's why you call it perfect world expectations. Yeah, perfect world expectations mean that things are priced at the absolute max as long as everything goes perfectly. So, you know, the pricing is correct if you have perfection for the future.
Yeah, we have profit without the potential for loss. You've got a guaranteed high rate of return with no downside. And can you imagine a more perfect world? You've got $15 trillion of Chinese money that cannot imagine a more perfect world either. That's why they're parked there. You've got the PBOC, which would like to reset those expectations. They've got to do this very carefully because they need to reset expectations without cratering the financial universe. You have moral hazard, which is alive and well in the Chinese markets, where only gain and the impossibility of pain, that's the presumption of investors today. That first, we need to see that there's the mistake by investors believing in a something for nothing pipe dream. Risk and reward have always been in the same equation. And if they're separated temporarily, they typically are slammed back together. You know, think of two magnets and that sort of compelling unseen force which brings them back together in spite of separation. But second, you've got the central bank that believes that they can actually tame the beast of investor appetite, and they can do that without crushing the spirit of the market. This is where I don't know what happens in China.
You know, Dave, in parenting, sometimes you have to let the lesson be learned the hard way so that your child can grow up into an adult and can be a responsible adult. But we've seen, and you've seen parents that are always praising their children, maybe praising them for things that aren't necessarily praiseworthy, but never allowing the negative to come in. Ultimately, that destroys expectations and destroys the child, and it creates the inability to ever become a responsible adult. In a way, you had mentioned the something for nothing pipe dream, and that really sticks with me right now, because you've got people in Bitcoin, I keep bringing it back, who are getting something for nothing, and they still swear up and down that it's not a bubble. You've got the same thing going on in the U.S. stock market. You've got the same thing going on with the $15 trillion in these asset management products that the government of China is making sure has no volatility. They're scratching their heads now going, wait a second, maybe we should have raised our children in a different way. Maybe we should have shown them that there were risks and that not everything turns out rosy. Can they pull that off, Dave? I mean, can that be pulled off anywhere in the world after this last 8 years of artificial stimulation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because for them to develop in the direction of free market capitalism, which, you know, it remains to be seen if the current administration puts them more on lockdown mode and the Politburo consolidates power and sort of moves things forward in a decidedly command and control way, or if, in fact, we continue to see a blossoming, flourishing free market system within China. But the free market, you know, this is, I recall a phrase from growing up, pain builds character. I think my dad said that just before I got a spanking or something. I don't remember. But pain builds character. There is character which needs to be built within the system of capitalism in China, and it's only going to be through pain. And I say that because unless a high degree of pain is felt by the Chinese market, they're going to continue to inflate their asset prices. Now, reach levels that ultimately remove People's Bank of China, the central bank there in China, their ability to even influence or let alone control outcome. And it's ironic that they want to cool the markets. They want to cool them down. But thus far, they've been timid. And when they begin to see too much of a shrinking in credit growth or what have you, then they reverse course. And I think what they're doing is they're creating a world in which the markets play off the central bank's fear of the unknown. When you can't predict an outcome and you act with timidity, then that timidity on the one side of the equation encourages more boldness from investors on the other side of the equation. And in fact, your best attempt to cool things off, in fact, just heats them up further. And in all likelihood, I mean, credit growth is going to continue. It'll continue in the shadow banking arena until you have a market collapse. And I don't know what the trigger is for a market collapse in China that's unknowable.
Well, one of the unknowable items, Dave, I mean, speaking of unknowable, is the fact that we now have a new People's Bank of China head. I mean, we've had 15 years of the same person. Now we're seeing a transition. Is it going to be just benign, like what we're going to see with Yellen and Powell? What do we know about the Chinese central bank head?
The real question remains a Politburo question. What do they hope to achieve over the next 5, 10, 15 years in terms of regional hegemony or in terms of international influence? And what is the optimal way to use monetary policy as a tool to complement those goals? Perhaps nothing changes. I mean, the PBOC, it's an extension of public policy. It can help shape financial market priorities. Nothing changes over here in the U.S. I mean, as we shift from Yellen to Powell coming into February of next year, essentially we've got the same policies as expected. This isn't me alone thinking this. Greg Ip from the Wall Street Journal had that same thing to say last week. You know, he says choosing Jerome Powell as Fed chairman is a safe gamble since his views match Janet Yellen's. And as I recall, he's never had one dissenting vote. He's always gone along with the party line. So, you know, in both cases, the king is dead. Long live the king.
Right. So maybe nothing changes. Dave, as we see countries who are trying to extend their influence, I mean, we talk about China and their resources. You know, we saw Russia 5 or 6 years ago. George Friedman told us that Russia would need to take over the breadbasket of Europe, the Eastern Europe, which was Ukraine. So that was a prediction that came true. What we're seeing, it seems, right now with China is that they're wanting to take over or at least have expanded influence on the breadbasket of Africa, which would be Zimbabwe. We've got a transition of power in Zimbabwe right now from Mugabe to a man that's sort of nicknamed the crocodile. And you just sort of wonder, I remember hearing your dad when we were in these conferences saying that, you know, China is extending their power through building friendships and applying money to those friendships. Do you see the same thing happening right now with China and Africa?
I do. And I go back to that same thought, the king is dead, long live the king. Does that apply in Zimbabwe as well? I haven't yet talked to friends of ours who live in the country, but as Mugabe steps aside, the quote-unquote coup sure looked more like a wrinkle-free succession plan, with the military facilitating a peaceful move to new leadership from Mugabe to, lo and behold, Mugabe's number two man.
The crocodile.
Yeah, granted, he left the country for a few months just before returning to take the helm. But, I mean, that seems to me like the drama of Kabuki theater. You've got the crocodile, as he's called, and he may have his own personality, but I doubt very seriously is number two in Mugabe's power structure that very much will change in terms of corruption and abuse of power. Frankly, corruption and abuse of power in Africa has become as stylized as thinking about zebras and elephants on the savanna. It's a part of the essence of the continent, right? Here's the deal. He's status quo on land seizures, so no one's going to get their land back. And you remember we've had a couple of fine gentlemen on the program to talk about Zimbabwean hyperinflation. They were farmers and had their land seized by Mugabe a number of years ago. They're not going to get their land back. No. But he is at least promising compensation for land that was seized.
Well, let me ask you, though, is that compensation in the pre-financial collapse or is that in devalued Zimbabwean dollars?
Right. I mean, if you look at today's fair market value on farmland, it's got to be near zero. You've had productivity, which has dropped to zero. You've got land, which has been left fallow for years and years now. And, you know, I think if you had a different kind of leader elected in Zimbabwe in the coming years, that would be a fascinating country to invest in. But it hinges on the character of the individuals at the top. And, you know, if you're looking at it from sort of a macro perspective, essentially Zimbabwe is a secular market low. You just don't have any catalyst for growth, and you may never get one.
Okay, but China is leaving a pretty substantial footprint there. Could that also be a reason for optimism or hope, at least from an economic standpoint?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I see where you're going with that. If you've got the crocodile, as he likes to be called, the new president, if he wants to revive the economy, you know, he can ink deals with the Chinese and get upfront development dollars in exchange for an option on food production into the future.
Meeting the immediate need, like we were talking about before, it's either income or food. If you're the lower the strata of the economy, you're either looking for income or you're just plain looking for food. And in Zimbabwe, food would be a very powerful tool, would it not?
Yeah, and I do not think that reviving the African breadbasket is a miracle. You've got the skills there. You've got organizations and people that could take the desolate landscape that exists today and return it to being a cash cow. But what that would require is allowing the free markets to operate in that space. That would be the fastest way to return the land to health and productivity. If that doesn't occur, then back to the Chinese will do it. And guess what they've done in every instance where they've sent money? They have provided labor to put together various infrastructure projects. So it hasn't been good for the locals, has not been good for the locals. It's brought in cash flow, and certainly that cash flow has gone to a few corrupt politicians at the top of the food chain. But that's basically the kind of footprint that China has left in Africa. They've been willing to step in. They want long-term access to resources. They've done that in Central and South America, looking at minerals and those resources. But Africa is different. It has a combination of minerals and strategic assets like that, but it also has food, which if you're feeding billions of people, the difference between success and failure in your One Belt, One Road project, maybe having a cheap supply of rice and maize and various other staples, which obviously Zimbabwe could provide. So in this African food chain, where is the crocodile? Where is the crocodile in terms of the African food chain? We know that corrupt politicians are at the top, and my guess is that he's going to sit there comfortably at the top himself.
You know something, Dave, keeping with the China theme that's been striking me is I think sometimes we're happy to say, yes, I don't believe anything on fake news, yet we can still be influenced by it. One of the influences that I know I've experienced is I've just repeated like a parrot, well, Trump hasn't really been doing anything. Trump really hasn't gotten much done, even though, you know, Trump is standing strong on some issue. He's not really actually affecting a lot. But actually, behind the scenes in China, that's really not the case. I wonder if the Chinese understand Trump, but he seems to be getting things done quietly. And in this particular case, it's one of those rare occasions where Trump is getting something done and not talking about it.
I think he's actually a master at the art of misdirection. You've got his Twitter feeds and his idiotic statements that he makes practically every day. But I think he's playing a very interesting game on trade. And you've got the mainstream media, which has written him off as a dolt, as an idiot. I'd say not so. Brash? Yes. Stupid? No. I mean, just since November, he's managed to oversee the slashing of import taxes on 187 imported goods by the Chinese, according to investors.com. That's no small task. Then on his recent visit to Beijing, he was offered what previous U.S. administrations have begged for, that is access for U.S. firms into China's financial industry. And twice, both, you know, in the courtship process before he went over, and then as he's actually leaving the country, twice he feigned indifference to the offer. And I don't presume to know what is going on in his mind, but it appears that he's managing the Chinese by keeping them off balance and keeping them guessing at what his grand strategy is.
Right.
He's doing a good job of it. I don't know if he has a grand strategy or not, but if he can imply one, then that's very effective in terms of the Chinese perception.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes, Dave, if part of his grand strategy is not having one, or at least giving the perception of not having one, and not telegraphing that, which, you know, it's interesting to me. It's sort of ironic, because when people have talked about dealing with Chinese businessmen, that's one of the things that they do. They don't telegraph their intentions. And in a strange way, even though it's in a different style through Trump, he's a hard guy to read. And I think the Chinese are getting a taste of their own medicine.
But a part of the reason he's so hard to read is because you have such a hard time taking him seriously. Just like you've got the North Koreans who you think, yeah, these guys are crazy. And on the one hand, they're either stark-raving lunatics, or they use that as a means of keeping you off guard. You know, they say,
yeah,
they can't possibly come up with an intelligent strategy. They're stark-raving nuts. You need to read the DSM-5 to figure out what's really going on in North Korea, because they're psychotic. I don't even know if they use the word psychotic in the DSM-5 anymore. They don't use any of the old psychological terms.
Well, you know, we talk about fake news, and it's getting harder and harder to actually determine what the truth is. You have to use a lot of wisdom and discernment in anything that you hear. But fake news is one thing. Fake data is another. And it seems that the financial markets, as we move to the European Central Bank now, the financial markets really don't know how to react to anything anymore, not just because of fake news, but it's the data behind that news. We've doctored GDP for so long, and unemployment for so long, and inflation for so long. How do you react to any of that data in an intelligent way?
Well, the growing concern with the European Central Bank, specifically Reuters has quoted Benoît Cœur, who's an ECB board member, an official at the ECB, an actual board member, who says, you know, fake data, the relative of fake news is a threat to economic stability. He says there's this growing prevalence of poor quality data, which risks fueling economic manias and panics. And it's like, when I read that here in the last few weeks, I thought, yeah, is that just dawning on him? Of course it stirs mania and panics. I mean, this is the point of having data out there, is to cajole and manipulate the crowd into doing something. And he goes on, Benoît points out that actions by economic agents could become less anchored to actual activity and more prone to manias and panics, with obvious implications for the economic and financial stability. And I quote the article to point out that those people who are deeply embedded in the system, who have benefited from fabricated statistics, at some point realize that there is risk of, you know, what they were using to sort of create this reality. What if people actually believe it? What if it's popularly accepted? Real risks are obscured and ignored. And, you know, that's a problem, because then when you have people ignoring risk, it's one thing to think positive thoughts, all for it. But it's another to think only positive thoughts and never keep it in balance with sort of the yin and yang of life. Societe Generale, Hélène Boukhabtseff, he's the head of global asset allocation. He says investors are way too optimistic. They're too optimistic and they're taking on too much risk in this low volatility environment, setting the stock market up for potential downfall. And he says, in a Goldilocks scenario of low interest rates, abundant liquidity, stable growth, and a focus on good Trump, investors continue to push asset prices, volatility, and leverage to historical extremes.
Right. It reminds me of our guest, Bill King. You know, he continually tries to point out that there's a reality behind the smokescreen.
You're right. King's been like a broken record on that. And, you know, over and over again, he'll say, yeah, it's the U.S. government, which for decades has used economic statistics and understated inflation and overstated employment, as well as GDP, as a means to sanction the Fed to paper over debt and declining living standards. And, you know, fake data is not new to our listeners.
Dave, one of the dangers of simulation when you're in a particular activity that could be life-threatening, you know, you're a rock climber. You and I have both flown private planes, you know, when they're training men for war. A simulation, unless it gives you as accurate a simulation as possible, can actually ultimately teach you a life-threatening habit. And, you know, I think of flying simulations, they can be very, very helpful in one respect, but the fact that you have a reset button, you can crash and crash and crash, it can cause you to start making decisions more loosely than the risk would allow. And in a way, the world market system, especially since September of 2011, when Draghi said, we will do whatever it takes, and they have since then done whatever it takes. In a way, we're training an entire world that there is no risk, there's only reward. Again, it's that free money mentality. And you just wonder, when reality does return, when that mountain that you are flying into, you know, to use the flying example, they say there's a mountain in that cloud sometimes, and a lot of times pilots don't realize it until they hit that mountain. When that happens, we've never really experienced a period of time of so much false or fake simulation as we've experienced in the last 6 years, have we?
No. And I think, again, this is where understanding your limits is very important. And that idea that you raise of flying in a simulation and getting to start over and not dealing with consequences. There are real world consequences to ignoring natural limits. Spoke with a fighter pilot the other day, spent many years in the Navy, and then has flown commercially and now with NetJets for a good bit of time. But he referenced bingo fuel when we were talking the other day. And he said, this is the amount of fuel that you know in your gauge. Doesn't matter what you have going on. It doesn't matter where you're at in a conflict engagement. If you don't turn around right then, you will crash your plane because you have exactly the amount of fuel required to get you back to the boat. And you have to drop everything and go. Because that is, again, it's the real data. You have to deal with reality in that moment. You can't press for another 2 seconds. You can't take the shot. If it just opens up, you have to deal with reality. You know, again, I think our listeners would say, yeah, you guys have talked about unemployment stats being fudged for some time and inflation stats being fudged for some time. What do you do as an ECB president or as a Fed official when you get this news flash that they're dealing and they've been fabricating their own fake data? On the one hand, it's liberating for me because I can do something about it. And you can do something about it. You can vote with your feet. But I think for them, they're really stuck. And investors with a modicum of wisdom, you know, they'll hedge their bets. And as a greater number of people come to the awareness that current surges in asset prices are built on a house of cards, you know, again, perception of fake news and fake data becomes the reality within the marketplace. People begin to hedge their bets. You do that in mass, and that's the turn of the market. That's the movement from a bull to a bear. We have these things emerging now, Kevin. I started by referencing the Bloomberg article and moving from $28 trillion in debt to $3 trillion, only $3 trillion left, but it's above 4%. And it's really an interesting thing. There is a growing awareness that something's not quite right. Investors are figuring it out. Analysts on Wall Street are figuring it out. They're not quite sure what behavior modification they should adopt, what they should do to change their portfolio structures. So they're not doing anything yet, but it's not lost on them anymore that we're in la la land. And as and when they decide to change course, this is where we begin to test the limits of liquidity in a lot of different markets and begin to see, I think, a radical adjustment price. I think this is a very interesting time as we transition in 2018, where people begin to act, not just observe and listen, but begin to act on what they know to be true. And I think this is, again, the point where an investor says, I have just enough fuel to land it. I need to disengage now and get home, put this thing on the ground.
Bingo fuel. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.